Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello, Egg Chasers. It's the Egg Chasers Rugby Podcast, the podcast about rugby that doesn't take itself or the game too seriously, and the podcast about rugby that, until the last 7 days, was very smug in its relentless energy and ability to churn out episodes week on week without any gap for the last 10 years, into our 11th season. That is still true, technically, but not in the manner you've become accustomed. Anyway, more on that in a little bit. I'm Tim in the rugby dungeon with JB.
Hello, Tim.
And Philip is saving lives by proxy down the line. How are you doing, Phil?
I think we're all saving lives, actually, by proxy. So yes, doing very well, very smug about myself, saving all those lives.
Yes.
That might sound strange unless you realise Phil's wife is an anaesthetist and is working, so Phil can't be with us because he's got two small children. If your kids can't be self-sufficient, at what age now, Phil?
Well, they're still technically 2 and 4.
Technically? What are they, 5 and 6, are they?
Well,
actually 5 and 6.
In 5 days, one will be 3.
Right.
And in 8 days, the other will be 5.
Oh, big so. Week. Big week. And Valentine's Day, that's the week after, if you go in for all that rubbish. Anyway.
Yeah.
I think, I'm going to say two things. I think we deserve, or people deserve an explanation, but I also think we should not do that right away on the podcast because there's so much amazing rugby to talk about. So we should put a pin in what happened in France and we should open that Pandora's box in a little bit. Does that sound all right?
Sounds good to me.
Excellent.
Great. Right, Six Nations. Does this not, every single February, just remind you how much and why you love this tournament?
To be honest, this weekend's been an absolute blur. So, yes, it does, because it's one of the weekends when I can actually inspire people to come and watch rugby, non-rugby people to go and watch rugby. So I took a group of people out on Saturday to watch 2 games. From my CrossFit box, which is very good fun, and I watched the Friday game. But yeah, it is exactly because it is the Six Nations and all of that around it, which is why you can mobilise civilians to actually watch this great game.
Yeah, and because Manchester is typically, it is a football city,
massive football
and
city.
Rugby is just way down the list. So it's one of the least rugby places in the UK.
Hang on. I'm going to just push back against that.
Oh yeah, go on.
So I'm not entirely sure that it is the least rugby place. I just think football is so massive. So I don't think there's like less rugby here than, say, Newcastle's another massive football city.
Absolutely.
I'm just trying to think of another comparable city. It's like Nottingham.
All of the northern cities.
Yeah. I don't think there's less rugby here. It's just that, God, they love football. I mean, they really love football. So I think it's more a testament to how big football is. But there's a huge rugby community here. We've got loads of good teams. And it's a little bit niche, but yeah, I'd say it's a pretty strong community.
So what were the pubs like in Manchester? What were the bars?
Full of football fans. Full of them. Now, we went to a place in Northern Quarter because we knew it would be playing. And Tip Street Tavern there, which is where I like to watch my rugby now. And it was packed. I've watched the Premiership Final there. I've watched all sorts of things there. So, yeah, they're pretty good for it.
Cool. Well, Phil, where did you watch the games?
All at home.
Lovely.
Unfortunately, because as well as working tonight, Claire's been working since, since about 7 a.m. on Friday morning going. So I've basically been solo parenting for the weekend, much like she was last weekend.
So much easier, though, wasn't it?
Right. So here's the thing, which I'm going to admit, right? So on this podcast, we're really honest. We bear all, and we will do when we talk about Paris. But I'm going to say the thing which I think, but I probably shouldn't say. I was in Cardiff for Wales v Scotland. The game was amazing. The atmosphere was incredible. I loved watching the Wales and Scotland fans, the banter and the camaraderie. It was absolutely awesome. Overall, I'm quite envious of you, Phil, watching it on your sofa. Not because when you're actually there, there's nowhere else I'd want to be. It's amazing. But the faff involved, particularly when you live in Manchester and the game's in Cardiff, it'd be fine if you were in Bristol and popping over.
Yeah.
But, just the queue for the trains. And I queued up...
Oh, the train station. God.
I queued up at Cardiff Central train station, and they let the train through that I was going to be getting on. And I was the first person when they pushed the barrier in front of me, not letting me through to the train.
Brilliant.
So I had to wait for another 48 minutes for the next train. It was
horrendous.
In the rain. It was horrendous. But the actual game itself with the roof on was incredible.
You know, it's funny you mention that, because I've never really been that fond of Cardiff as a rugby city. Now, it's obviously got incredible heritage. And saying that, literally as I say that, I can remember all of the phenomenal times that I had in Cardiff.
Yeah.
So in the Six Nations back in the day, we would get in the car from Manchester. My friends from North Wales would pick me up. Dear friend of the pod, Bryn Williams. We would fly down to Cardiff at speeds which are not appropriate, get there, and then just drink ourselves silly for 2 days. Now, the problem with rugby, I found this yesterday, and I found this out in Japan, and I probably found it out last week in Paris. Depends what you want from it, but if you really enjoy the game, and I do really enjoy the game, you can't really drink. That is where I've come to now. I do drink, but if I'm drinking, I know that the game of rugby is not going to be as enjoyable, because you just can't watch it. You've got to concentrate. Like, if you turn off for 5 minutes and then you look back up at the screen, and the teams can be in a different quarter of the field.
I can give you a perfect example of this. During the Rugby World Cup, that incredible quarter-final weekend, I was in Marseille, so that they were the two games in the evening, early evening, and then the late kickoffs were the games in Paris. On the first night, I went straight from the whatever game it was. Was it England? England, Fiji, whatever it was. And I went straight there, and I went down to the port in Marseille to get on it whilst watching Ireland, New Zealand. So excited. And the next day, I felt like I'd enjoyed my night, but I hadn't absorbed the rugby. And So I spent the next night, bearing in mind I was in France, I spent the next night and I watched South Africa, France. I watched that on my laptop in the camper van, yes, completely on my own.
And the difference being is, if you're watching it with people who are not watching it, they want to talk to you, then you won't. So actually, when I watch rugby with you and Phil, that's completely different, because I'm constantly talking about the game. And because you're talking about the game and what's happening on the field, that reinforces what you're seeing, and it's good for the podcast. If you're watching it over a beer, forget it. Like, if you're with people who don't want to watch it, forget it. If you're in the rugby club and everyone's focused on it, yeah, that'll work. But it's when nobody is watching it and everyone wants to chat and there's other things to, you know, draw your attention away, you're just not going to enjoy it.
And for that reason, it may have been a slight silver lining that there was no proper podcast last weekend, because I don't know what we would have talked about.
Do you know, I don't remember a single thing from that game.
Bordeaux, Stade Francais and Toulouse. Racing to lose.
Bordeaux Stade Francais, I remember quite a lot of. The Racing game, I remember watching Khaleesi do a few nice things, but not being worth the money. And that's it, really. That was it. So, anyway.
I remember DuPont, and I remember Blair Kinghorn's languid running style.
Oh, he was good, wasn't he, actually? Yeah. To be fair.
Yeah.
Yeah, so maybe I remember more than I'm.
Henry Arundel did nothing as well.
Yeah, his world's going to change drastically next season. Drastically change.
Right, so I tell you what, let's start on Friday night. So we all actually watched this game, right?
Yep.
properly with no beers involved.
Yeah, there's so many things to talk about.
What a game.
It was a good game. Well, was it a good game? Was it what a game? Go on, you tell me why, and I'll tell you why I was kind of disappointed.
It wasn't a competitive game, but... and France were disappointing. So the contrast in this game, I think, bubbles down to two teams that have reacted to World Cup disappointment in two very different ways.
Mm.
I think France are still mourning, and I think they're still hungover. I was in France at the World Cup, and honestly, the next day, it was like there'd been a massive catastrophe in the country, like some terrorist attack or a very high profile death or something. It was just eerie. Suddenly rugby didn't exist, and all those posters of DuPont everywhere on every bus stop just kind of, I don't know,
went.
They just sort of,
they had an apocalyptic feel to
them. They felt grey. Yeah. So I just think France haven't got over it. They were building up for that World Cup, a home World Cup, for a good decade, putting all the processes in place, building up their players. They had this proper swagger. And they've changed all their coaching staff since. Some of the real big names that they were relied upon the last few years, like Donty, Willemser, just looked shadows of themselves. And obviously their captain and talisman wasn't there. I don't know. What do you think, Phil?
I think you can definitely make the argument, and probably that's the argument I would go for. I was interested to read Dan Bigger's comments on this, where... He said it's not a hangover as much as it is the attrition of the top 14 versus the strategic player management of the IRFU, and where all the top 14 players just immediately had to go back to the meat grinder, and the IRFU were able to manage their players. And I think from Bigger's perspective, there's a little bit of a dig. Or no, is it a dig or is it a little bit sour grapes?
Yeah, I was going to say,
not quite sure.
Dan Bigger, you're getting rewarded handsomely for that meat grinder.
Yeah, exactly. There's something to that. Now he's obviously got the perception of playing in the URC or Rabo Direct or whatever you want to call it,
Rainbow
Pro 14
Cup.
Rainbow Cup. Yeah, maybe he didn't play in the Rainbow Cup, but playing in the rest of it against the Ireland players who were very well managed, and generally to Dan Bigger's detriment that they were well managed. So it's maybe two reasons for him to be a little bit sour about it. But that is maybe, there is probably a little bit of column A and a little bit of column B.
Mm.
Yeah, well, you know, France, for me, they just sort of reverted back to who we kind of thought they were originally. They've always been a superbly talented team with superb forwards, well, just superb talent. But occasionally they don't show up. And I think the World Cup really focused their attention, and now the World Cup's not there. So I don't think it's a hangover. I just think you're seeing what France really are. This is France. This is it. And I remember watching this and thinking, God, yeah, it tells a story about France, but that's why I love them. But it also tells me why I hate Ireland so much. And it's like, well done, guys. You've won this game. But ultimately, what was the point? Do you know what I mean? Like, you know, well, congratulations for peaking at exactly the right time, which was approximately one game after the World Cup. You absolute heroes. And they'll be joyous about this now. They'll be like, this is one of the most significant victories. No, 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 no. It's just a victory after one of your most significant ever losses. And it's just, it's exactly what both these teams are. France, you know, unfocused and talented. Ireland, absolutely magnificent when nobody cares. And that's what happened.
Well, I wasn't quite going to frame it in that way, but I was going to talk about Ireland because Ireland did a brilliant job of shutting down France. And they shut them down for 70 plus minutes of this game. France got their dander up a couple of times right at the end of that first half when they scored the Penaud try after countless enormous phases and offload and fastball. Mm. And then again, midway through the second half when they scored their second try. Besides that, Ireland just shut them down, like completely shut France down.
Wrecked their line out.
It almost, wrecked the line out, adequate the scrum, allowed Ireland to get fastball when they wanted to. Generally, apart from those two moments, slowed the French ball down, and handled those massive French forwards. with one of the one, I thought it was an absolutely huge performance from McCarthy.
He was class, wasn't he?
So even Andy Farrell calls him Big Joe. So I think if Andy Farrell calls him Big Joe, I think I'm happy to adopt that moniker. Big Joe was immense. And Ireland have got a legitimate tight headlock. And I was trying to think, what's the last legit tight headlock they've had?
Well, anyone's had, really. I mean, there was
like Devon Toner.
Devon Toner. Yeah, Devon.
But even him, I mean, was he a tight headlock?
Yes, he was. Yeah,
he was big, he was tall. But you wouldn't want him to... I mean, he couldn't do what McCarthy does. McCarthy's carrying is just brilliant.
It's Etzebeth-esque.
Do you know, McCarthy, though, I know he's a different type of player, but his carrying is more reminiscent of Henderson. Just explosive into contact. So actually, in terms of the last tight headlock, depending on what you want him to do, if you want just a big bloke to push in the scrum, that's slightly different. But his carrying was good. So, yeah, maybe Henderson. The Six Nations, I don't think there's been that many explosive carriers like him. But, hey, he looked great. I loved to watch him. I loved him. And I loved their new 10. What's his name again?
Crowley.
Jack Crowley.
Yeah, he was very good.
So, those are the two that stood out for me.
Jack Crowley got me thinking of something that you often talk about, JB. We talk about on the pod, the graveyards are full of indispensable men.
This is exactly what I was thinking when I was watching him. Exactly it.
God, he was so good. He was so composed. His distribution was so good. His kicking, both off the tee and out of hand, was so good.
Well, there was moment when he missed the kick in front of the post from 40 metres and then Tomás Ramos scored. And so it went from, it could have been 13-0 and it went to 10-3.
Yeah.
And I did think at that point, oh, is this international rugby pressure, just getting to Jack Crowley? But actually, he did this the other week. I forget the game it was he was playing for Munster. It might have been Bayonne in the Champions Cup. And he had a shocker early on and then just got a man of the match performance, just grew into it. And he just looked so mature.
Yeah, it's exactly what Ireland needed. And I've been talking about this for a little while. I'm not saying it was the wrong thing to do, and I'm not saying that I wouldn't have done it, or that there's not massive utility in older players, because you've heard about my plan of setting up a club and only having players aged 35 and over, right?
Yeah.
So, but the Sexton thing must have cost Ireland millions and millions of pounds, not just to pay him, which is one thing, but also to pay him not to play, which was most of what he did, and then pay for other players to play in his place. And then, in addition to that, the cost of not being able to put someone in the Irish 10 jersey for significant amounts of time.
I'm going to agree and disagree. I think all of that was vindicated because Johnny Sexton was a generational talent. However, and this is...
But he lost the quarterfinal.
No. Well, that's what I was going to say. Yeah. I would actually put this on Andy Farrell's shoulders. The one mistake, the one big mistake he has made as Ireland head coach, as I see it, was not taking Johnny Sexton off after about 50 minutes of that quarterfinal, because he was dead on his feet. And I think it was a sentimental decision to keep him on the field. And I think had he changed it was Jack Crowley on the bench that day? Or was it Ross Byrne? I forget. I think it might have been Jack Crowley. Anyway, whoever it was.
I think it was Jack Crowley.
If he'd brought Jack Crowley on with half an hour to go, I think Ireland win. I think Ireland beat New Zealand.
I think it's a good... Yeah, why not?
So I'm sure that's something Andy Farrell has probably reflected on. And I take your broader point that all the eggs were in that Sexton basket, and therefore, when it came to a World Cup, he didn't have the confidence to take off Johnny Sexton with nothing left in the tank.
Imagine the story of taking off. They lost a quarterfinal, and everyone says, okay, well, lost. No one's really pointed any fingers at Andy Farrell. I don't think I would either. They got beaten by a better team, and that happens in rugby. But had he not started Sexton and lost the quarter final, then he probably would have lost his job.
I guess so. And I'm also just going to slightly... I've been thinking about this with the point you made about Ireland, winning a game when no one cares. I think there's definitely a balance here, and I was reflecting on the fact England had a relatively good World Cup, almost getting to a World Cup final, being beaten very narrowly by the eventual champions, finishing third. Ireland got knocked out at a quarterfinal. However, the last four years have been miserable being an England fan.
Yep.
Until that semi-final. Whereas Irish fans have had a wild time of it.
Yeah, but
first ever series win in New Zealand, and on New Zealand sort of grand slams. Like, actually, there's something to be said for taking the pots and taking the success and the wins wherever they come and having a good time along the way.
Okay. Would you rather the dull misery of being an England fan with a spike of joy at the end, or do you like the dull enjoyment of being an Ireland fan with a spike of misery at the end?
If I could have chosen the last 4 years, I'd be an Ireland fan, no question.
With a spike of misery for the World Cup quarterfinal?
Yeah, 100%.
Done. Okay, I mean, I think that's fine. I mean, that's a trade-off that you make. And for me, the biggest Ireland game is not going to be in this Six Nations. It's going to be in the Heineken Cup. That is the biggest Ireland game. And if they lose that, then, you know, the Six Nations to me doesn't really matter that much for Ireland this year. It'll be the Heineken Cup.
I don't know. I think the Six Nations, enjoy every success.
Enjoy every success, get absolutely smashed, and then fail to win the competition that you've been trying to win for so long again.
Only one team can.
It's not going to be an Irish team, unfortunately.
Well, they look really good. They're big players. And when you look at the age profile of the players that really stepped up, Jack Crowley's, what, 24? Joe McCarthy's 22. Caelan Dorris has still got lots of years in him. He was immense. They're in a good place.
Yeah, if I was an Irish fan, I'd be so excited about the two players that we've spoken about. Mm. I mean, like, really excited. It is great to see. And they do need a turnover of leadership. So, yeah, it's brilliant.
And with that game, the opening game on the Friday night of the Six Nations, is the Six Nations now over?
No.
No, it depends how next weekend goes. It's interesting that the rounds one and round two, the biggest game of the weekend is the first match that we watch. Yeah. So next weekend, Saturday, first up, the 2:15 kickoff, is it? That is Scotland against France. If Scotland manage to win that, then it could be all on a Grand Slam decider in Dublin on the final day.
That's England.
On Super Saturday.
I assume England have got something to say about this.
Well, England have got to go to Murrayfield. So yeah, England do have something to say about that. And they could beat Scotland in Murrayfield. But what I'm saying is this feels significant for Scotland, bearing in mind the way the game went yesterday, and also for France, bearing in mind they lost on Friday night. It feels huge, this game.
Yeah, completely agree. Now,
I do have to say, it's a big game, but I just can't see Scotland beating France and then going away to Dublin, which is what I'm pretty certain they will have to do in order to win. Because Ireland are not going to lose another game. And they're not going to lose to England. And they're not going to lose to Wales. And Ireland are not going to lose to Italy.
Let's find out.
I think, unfortunately, the tournament is done. Because Ireland are just going to walk it from here.
Yeah.
Be good if there was relegation, wouldn't there?
No. Or, why? Why? No.
A relegation playoff. Because how exciting would Italy-Wales or Wales-England be?
Well, we wouldn't be watching Italy-Wales. They'd have been relegated a long time ago. So, just something which I found myself thinking on Friday night, which is, I can't believe I've got something in common with the Change the Behaviour Brigade. Because Paul Wilhelmsey, or whatever his name is, has to change his behaviour.
He
was ridiculous.
The second one. It's the second one particularly, the one he got given a straight red card for. I did actually have an element of sympathy on his first one. I don't disagree it was a yellow card. By the current laws of the game. But I also have sympathy because he was kind of supporting a player in that sort of tackle breakdown area.
I was astonished it was a yellow card for the first one.
Really?
Not because I wouldn't give
it. You thought it was a straight red?
No, I just thought it was astonishing. I think we are winning the argument on the head injuries and how the game should be played. So the fact that that was yellow is really good for me. But I was astonished that Dixon didn't give a red. I thought he'd given a red just because of the pressure he comes under. But I think
he deferred the call, didn't he?
You're not allowed to give reds now, are you? Are you?
Do they have to go to... No, a referee can give them.
I think they all have to go to...
I don't think it's have to. I think the referee says it meets the threshold, therefore you're in the... It goes to the bunker.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, there is, you can still give a red on the pitch, but the incentive is not to give a red on the pitch because unless it is you've punched someone in the face or clearly kicked someone in the head or something like that, discharge the decision to a subordinate who's got 10 minutes to deal with it.
So, the first one, I was and very surprised it wasn't a red. And the second one, I thought, bloody hell, he's just given him no choice now. Like, you can't, the only way he stays on the field is if he doesn't get a yellow card. And there's no way you can not give that man a yellow card, bearing in mind what he's just done. So, yeah, happens.
Just on the kind of winning the argument, the
Luke Crosby.
Yeah, Luke Crosby. The similar, it was kind of similar.
Similar to the first one.
Yeah.
The first yellow card. But there was a clear difference in that Crosby was binding on and Villemza was not binding on. But other than that, it was quite a similar decision.
I love that not even a penalty was given for that.
Mm. Yeah,
I was imagining that it was going to be, oh, I've mitigated it, so it's yellow, or even mitigated again, and it's a penalty. I love the fact that there was an acknowledgement from the official. Was it Ben O'Keefe in that game?
It was, yes.
Yeah, there was an acknowledgement from Ben O'Keefe that accidents happen in rugby, and you cannot avoid head contact.
Correct. All things are correct, and yeah, it is good to see.
Yes, but Villemza, he's got to do something different. I mean, he's probably going to get he might not even get another chance, even if he's is available for the last Six Nations game in this tournament, just because, well, you know, he's just had two yellow cards, yeah, of which the second yellow card obviously makes a red card, and then the second yellow card got upgraded to a red card.
Is this the first player in history to maybe get two reds in the same game?
He didn't technically get two reds, but I know what you mean.
Well, he's got two yellows, that's a red, and then he got a red from his yellow.
Yeah, but the second yellow was doesn't exist anymore when it got upgraded to a red.
I'm giving him two reds for this.
Yeah.
Double is fine.
His ban should be enormous. Just for that. Just for the administrative time it has taken.
With all that said, did you feel I just felt sorry for the guy. He's probably never going to play for France again. He's been a brilliant player for them. He only got back in because there was a bunch of injuries, he missed out on the World Cup, and he comes back and then that happens.
Yeah. Well, do you know, there's only the best way to redeem yourself in international rugby. Well, do you know what it is? The best way. And he can do this. He's one of the few players that can do it. Be 130 kilograms. It's amazing what they'll let you get away with.
I thought you were going to say, JB, the best thing that he's one of the few players who is eligible to do is defect and go and win a World Cup with South Africa.
Yeah, stop playing. Oh, hang on. Is it 5 years he needs to stop playing for?
Three.
It's three. So if he stopped playing now, he would just be available for the next World Cup.
Razzie loves picking like 36-year-olds.
Christ, with all that experience as well.
Jean Klein, like the last one, like last World Cup.
Yeah, Paul Villemza, stop playing, win a World Cup in 4 years.
Imagine pulling on the Springbok green. That'd be amazing, wouldn't it?
That would be fun.
Yes, do that. Do that. 100% do that.
Just like Alec Hepburn pulled on the Blue of Scotland this weekend.
Yes.
Yes, he did.
Yeah.
So, do you want to talk about Scotland?
Yeah. But just before I do, just on the Marseille thing, I think you got a sense of what the stadium was like from this game. That stadium is insane. But how good was it hearing a national anthem without a child's choir?
Yes.
Backing it up. That Marseillaise was amazing.
Yeah, that's one part of the World Cup I'm not sad to see the back of.
Yes, agreed.
Scotland. So the first thing I'm going to say about Scotland is, if you're with a bunch of people that don't understand rugby, probably the best thing you can do is make them watch Finn Russell. That's easily the best thing, because everyone can understand that guy's a genius.
He really is.
Yes.
Do you know, the thing that impressed me most about Finn Russell was the way he spoke after the game as captain.
Was he captain?
Yeah. Oh.
Yeah.
Do you know we've not spoken about Finn Russell's appearance on the Netflix documentary?
Yeah, well,
because we missed a week and we also, yeah, so that happened.
Well, so in the post-match interview after the game, he said, among the various things he said, was there's a lot of our guys need to have a look in the mirror because they were not doing what they were told. I was saying to them, we were giving away so many penalties. I was saying to them, do not go into the rucks. And some of them kept going into the rucks. And it was so refreshing to hear a player be so open and honest and willing to actually criticise his teammates.
Yeah, yeah.
On TV, you just never hear interviews like that. And I thought it was awesome. And that is a little bit like the insight from the Netflix thing. He felt like he was more open book.
Greg
than most,
and
you got the sense that Finn Russell would have been okay with the cameras completely following him round.
Yeah,
in fact, in a way that they did not, the teams did not let the cameras happen.
Yeah. So, what was Finn's quote? Gregor has his ideas, I have my ideas.
Yeah.
I'm on the field. Okay. Yeah. Guess that's
and then a laugh. He said that with a laugh, but I'm the one on the field.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Many a true word is spoken in jest.
Well, Gregor's made him captain, so I think he knows.
Yeah, because Gregor's job is totally reliant on him playing. In fact, Gregor's legacy is entirely based on Finn Russell winning games. So I'm not surprised. And look at what the guy is doing at Bath. So, you know, he's revitalised Bath. The guy's just a brilliant, brilliant player for rugby. And do you know what's even better about him? When I was sitting down and I was explaining to people who... Well, I didn't bother explaining who anyone else is because everyone else is basically much an identical rugby player. They're massive. They're impressive human specimens. And then here's this slopey-shouldered guy sort of sauntering around the field. But that there is the best rugby player maybe on the planet. He's certainly one of the best in the Six Nations and he'll be the best today. And he was. He was absolutely brilliant. Well, sometimes he's brilliant. He had moments of magic.
Yeah. You could say to your CrossFit colleagues, you would beat him in most wads.
Yeah.
But that guy is the best rugby player.
Do you know that working out that we do every single day? Yeah, all that? Waste of time. Total waste of time. So,
oh, dear.
Well, I'll tell you who is a absolute physical specimen, though. Goodness me. That Duan van der Merwe try.
Wow.
The first one he scores, I mean, the second one he scores is all about Finn Russell, and that was beautiful in its own right. P has got, I mean, he's a big bloke, and we know that. He's strong, we know that. He does not get enough credit for how fast he is. To go on the outside of an international winger and not be touched at that size is quite extraordinary.
I think only in the Six Nations, Lewis Rees-Sammet's not there. I would say he could finish that, make that finish.
Yeah.
Damien Penno, I think, is the only other winger in the Six Nations that could have finished that.
I can only think that if it's not his raw speed, maybe his size makes people hesitant to commit in the way that they otherwise would do, which allows him to get on the outside. But, yeah, that's an international winger. And he doesn't... I don't think he got touched.
He did not get touched. That was his second try, wasn't it? The one just
after half-time, 27-0 they were at that point.
Did he get three tries?
Two.
No, that was his first try.
No, first try was...
The Finn Russell one. The Finn Russell ghosting through.
Yes.
Right, okay, I've got them.
Yeah. So it was the start of the second half, round the right winger. Round the Wales left wing. It was Duan on his opposite wing, wasn't it?
Yeah, something happened and Duan scored an amazing try.
It was an incredible try. At which point they were 27-0 up and it was, honestly, the I was at the Principality Stadium, it was dead. It was like a library at that point. The atmosphere before the game was amazing. First quarter of an hour, it was pretty good. It was just eerily quiet and then it just went off.
Last 30 minutes, wasn't it?
Wild.
Last 30 minutes was... I mean, you end up saying, how did Wales not win this? You go from a position of saying, how have Scotland not buried them, to how did Wales not win this? Was it 26 unanswered points?
Yeah.
Yes.
Goodness me. I don't think I've ever seen anything like that.
27-0 until 26-27. It was reminiscent of Scotland at Twickenham about 5 years ago.
Yeah. Although somehow different, wasn't it? Because Scotland ripped England to pieces. You know, they went. I remember the Hugh Jones try. I don't know if it was Hugh Jones actually scored, but I remember the pass to Hugh Jones. And it was a different kind of game. Well, this one is a bit more gritty.
This was lots of penalties given away by Scotland. Kick to the corner, and the Welsh maul was awesome.
Well, before when it was 20-0, did you notice the penalty stats? It's like four penalties Wales had given away to however many Scotland had, and Scotland were in like double digits. But bloody hell, that's strange. I've never seen a team give away so few penalties and get so badly beaten. But it seemed to come back and haunt them later on.
Mm. Well, that was a big story of the game, I think. Because in the first half, it was Wales gave away. I think it was four in the first half, and I think it was four all game that Wales gave away.
That's incredible, that is.
Scotland gave away 16 penalties. But the story of the first half was Wales just couldn't do anything with them. So at the end of the first half, in the last 5 minutes, Scotland gave away five penalties in their own half. The first three were kicked into the corner and Wales missed all three lineouts. So you have three back-to-back-to-back lineouts in Scotland's 22.
Yep.
Miss, miss, miss. The fourth penalty, they kicked to the corner, a missed touch.
It. Yeah, that's when Yo and Lloyd had just come on.
And the fifth penalty to finish the first half, they managed to kick it into touch, finally secure a line-out, and Nick Tompkins immediately knocks on the first phase.
Yeah.
So you've had five back-to-back-to-back. I think it was just the last 5 minutes was all Scotland penalty, Wales territory, Scotland penalty, and they just couldn't do a single thing with it.
And also, I think David Jenkins knocks on the ball with a big carry. Mm. So he knocked on maybe first half, just spilled the ball. Cheers.
That was earlier on in the first half, in a good position as well.
Yeah. So I was trying to work out what the game plan was for us. Trying to work out everything in my head. So the game plan for Wales seemed a bit odd. I just want to revisit the penalty thing as well. Like, that truly is remarkable for such a young and experienced team to give away so few penalties. I mean, the discipline across the team and with the injuries to be that cohesive, not to give away penalties and not to panic as well. You're 20 points down, you're still not giving away penalties. That's pretty special, actually.
I do wonder how much of it was, because you know how referees, they will say that they don't, but they always will a little bit even things up.
Yeah.
And because Wales were getting so badly hammered and couldn't get anything right, and with a big crowd behind them, and a big crowd when they got going behind them, I'm not sure if you played this again in different circumstances, whether the penalty counts would end up the same.
I didn't know if I was being out of turn in saying so, or like, but I had exactly the same thought. And there were a few of the decisions I was going, and a few times Wales were lying all over Scottish ball going, I thought we just saw when Scotland did that a minute ago, you were straight on the whistle. And then, so I think there might be a bit of that, which you always get. Maybe that's just that's why it's so hard to win away from home, which is why, despite, I know it will feel a bit like a loss, even though they won for the first time in Cardiff in 22 years, no less. But that shouldn't be taken lightly. It's a win nonetheless. But at the same time, Wales have got a bit of hope. In terms of the game plan that Wales were playing that you touched on, Jay.
What was it?
To play off nine. Like Gareth Davis was the main playmaker and he had an absolute shocker. got taken off at half time. Thomas Williams was so much better.
But what about the kicking game that they were playing with? So they had Costello deep and they were just hoisting up.
Yeah, for the most part they were doing box kicks, and then they were just, like you say, Costello back in the pocket when they had a couple of phases. If it didn't work, either Gareth Davis would go to the air or Costello would sit back in the pocket. So, but neither of them were very good.
So that's great. Okay, that is a marvellous strategy. If you feel you're like the best defensive team on the planet, so South Africa would be pretty good at that, I guess. England can do that very well. But when you've got these young lads, and it's not a heavyweight team either, is it? So I find that a bit strange. And when they did do well, I thought the strengths of the team were, I thought David Jenkins carrying was great, really good. Wainwright was devastating at times.
Tommy Rafael at the breakdown was really good.
Yeah, he was good. And moving it side to side, I thought they looked really good.
Yeah.
The guy who I wasn't impressed with was the new fullback, Winnett.
I thought he was all right. I thought Watkin was the one that I didn't think played very well.
Yeah, to the point that I don't remember anything he did. So at least I remember the bad things that Winnett did.
I thought Winnett did all right.
Yeah, so at the end he had a lovely touch. I can't remember what it was for, but he had a really nice touch. But other than that, the most damning thing I can say about a player is that they look hesitant. So he gets the ball and he just doesn't accelerate. He doesn't look confident with it. And then as he's hitting the line, he just looks weak. He looks weak and ineffectual.
He's 19. He's only played a handful of senior games.
Yeah, I mean, when you put it like that, I feel very harsh saying it. But that's just my impression of watching him in that game. So I didn't know he was 19. I know nothing about him, just saying what I saw. So I feel awful now. But yeah, he looked hesitant. That is very damning. But tell you who looked hesitant when they were 19 was Joe Cocconesinga. I've always said that, looks hesitant. So they've got to work out the game, and it is a fast game.
Yeah. Well, actually, Wales had nothing else they could do. 27-0 down, they had to let the shackles off. And the game plan that they were clearly trying to do and couldn't execute, they had to just throw away. And actually, Johan Lloyd did really well when he came on in that context. And it seemed like the Wales players were more comfortable. Rio Dyer looked really into it when that was happening.
God, he played really well.
He played really well. So I think there's an element. And, you know, Barry John passed away this weekend.
Mm-hmm.
Welsh legend, the king, as he was known. And that you always talk, Jay, about leaning into the DNA of a club or a team. When I think of Wales, I think of like the skill set to play expansively when it's on, and I think Gatland should allow these youngsters to do that a bit more, because they actually seem really comfortable doing that.
What do I think? I mean, the problem is I've kind of grown up on a steady diet of Warren Gatland now since, well, he took over. When did he take over? God knows how long ago. So
2007, 2008.
Yeah, to me, Wales is just gritty, staying in the game. And occasionally they like to play. Occasionally they can play.
Actually, to be fair, maybe a Gatland game is play that way, pound, 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 pound for 60 minutes, and then let it go.
Yeah.
When the other team's knackered, like...
He will do whatever works. I think Warren Gatland looks at his box of toys and thinks, we don't really have what we need to play this game plan. We'll play something else. And that's just how Wales have always done things. I thought Tomkins actually looked like an absolute hero. Again, last 30 minutes, everyone did. But I feel he might even have captaincy potential going forward for Wales. Particularly if something happens to Jenkins. Jenkins is going to grow into one hell of a player. One hell of a player.
He looks so calm. There was all the pyrotechnics going off. There was the smoke in the tunnel. He was standing there. The camera was right in front of him. He could hear the noise, and it was so loud. And you just saw him on the big screen as he was in the tunnel ready to walk out. He just looks so chilled out.
What is he, like 21?
21.
Yeah, and he's not going to get weaker, is he?
No.
You know, he's not going to get, you know, this isn't the peak. His carrying is great. I like him carrying... Just a slightly wider off nine, he'd make some serious yardage. I love it, in fact. And Wainwright out wide, dynamite.
Yeah, he's great.
Yeah, Wainwright in that last 30 minutes was amazing.
Yeah, I don't know really where I stand on Wales now. Imagine, so this is, I just want to contrast Wales versus Ireland a second. But the privilege that Ireland have of taking two really talented youngsters and bleeding them into an experienced team compared to what Wales have, which is let's rip it all up and start again. And it just feels like Wales, they are always ripping it up and starting again. So if they can keep this lot together for a while, but there again, they've got players to come back too. Yeah, it's not going to be an absolute disaster, and that's encouraging.
The only thing with this, my concern with this Wales team will be, I think there is some positive green shoots, and they will certainly be building on that last 30 minutes, is that had a few other things not gone their way, they could have been 50 points down. They could have been 40 or 50 to nil down, and that would, there would be no green shoots in that situation. And if they're not careful against, well, specifically Ireland or France, that will be exactly what happens.
Yeah, and it's very difficult with this team to kind of assess, was this a success or was it not? And it's inexperience, because it's the inexperience that probably meant that they messed up all those lineouts, that they didn't make touch, that they did, that made all those mistakes. Probably the same inexperience that allows them to play such expansive rugby, you know, making the right decisions.
Now, just going back to the Netflix full contact thing, there wasn't nearly enough access to the teams, the team talks, the meetings in the dressing room during games. If they have not got that dressing room mic'd up at half time for both teams and full time, properly mic'd up and all access, I want to know what Warren Gatland was saying. Do you reckon he was absolutely roasting his team, or because they're kids, do you reckon he was trying to just strategically solve problems?
I legitimately have no idea, which is weird, isn't it? You'd think you'd have an idea after watching rugby for so long.
He said it was the worst half of that any Wales team under him has ever played.
Wow. Yeah. Okay, that's a big shout, isn't it? Yeah.
He also said after the game that ruck speed and line out were two things to fix. And they did, like, unequivocally, they fixed their ruck speed and line out, or certainly they were considerably better in the second half. So it might just be as simple as that, but with a few more Kiwi expletives thrown in.
Gatland is very similar to me, to Rob Baxter, which is he manages to reduce a very...
Sorry, I thought you were saying Gatland is very similar to me, as in to you.
Oh, no.
No.
Gatland is very similar to me as... it's a terrible wording. He's very similar to Rob Baxter, which is that he can take a very complex game like rugby, and you look at the Welsh... If you looked at the Welsh performance at half-time and us three sat down and tried to dissect what was happening, we say, oh, the line-out was terrible. We'd describe all the symptoms, and we'd be right to describe symptoms, but we wouldn't get the underlying cause. what makes Gatland and Baxter so brilliant is they just get the underlying cause. They'll point out two things, and then they fix those two things, and most of the symptoms disappear.
Well, again, two things he did, which helped to solve the line-out and the ruck speed issue, is he removed his hooker and scrum half from the field.
Yep, good. Yeah, that will do it for you.
Yeah.
So, yeah, pretty...
yeah, bold calls, but they worked. And the Johan Lloyd, we already mentioned, but the Johan Lloyd swap for Costello, that worked well. I know that was an enforced change, but yeah. that helped speed things up as well.
Tell you what, as a pair of fly halves, they don't inspire confidence. They're not rock stars, are they?
It's not like having Untermack and Jalibert as your like one
it's
and
not.
Two, or Farrell and Ford as your
Moonga and D-Mac.
Yeah.
Even
Finn Smith, Marcus Smith and Ford.
Yeah. You know,
there's so many good fly halves, and Wales have got two guys who hopefully they'll come good.
Mm. Yeah, they're young, and they've got enough talent that with enough experience they can come good.
Yeah.
Okay, before we talk about rugby anymore, let's do this. Let's go there. So if you've been listening to the podcast for a while, thank you very much for listening. You may well be just finding us for the very first time because this is Six Nations and you're interested in rugby. We are always there for you 52 weeks of the year, every single Monday morning. And that was technically true last week, but not really. We had a weekend away in Paris. Our friend of the pod and Egg Chasers Sevens team member, Lewis.
And General Fixer.
General Fixer. Lewis organised an absolutely belting week in Paris. We had an apartment that was literally next to the Arc de Triomphe. It was 50 metres away from the Arc de Triomphe. It was a sensational location. Brilliant weekend. We were there to watch Racing 92 versus Toulouse, which we went to watch on Sunday night. Phil's already mentioned the shocking work rate of Henry Arundel. And fantastic quads, though, to give him credit. Jack Willis was immense.
Yes.
Blair Kinghorn was great. We saw Antoine Dupont in his final game for a while for Toulouse. But there was no podcast for the three of us as we would have liked to have done it on Monday morning. Who wants to start?
Sorry, I thought we were going to talk for a second then about child abuse in rugby. That's what I thought you said, like, let's do it. I thought we were going to talk about that. We'll talk about France. We'll talk about the child abuse thing in a second, shall we?
Sure.
Yes. Okay.
Where shall we start, boys?
I know where you should start, but I'm not gonna force you to do it.
Well, so we were meant to record at 4 o'clock. I think this is quite a good story. And instead of recording at 4 o'clock, we thought, well, we can push it back a bit. We can have a few beers, and we did have a few beers. And we had a few beers with a good friend of mine, Ben, and his good friend Paul. So Ben and Paul came to join us, and it turns out that Ben and Paul know a thing or two about rugby. Would you agree?
I would, although I would correct what you're saying. You're saying is when I was called to come for a beer with Ben and Paul, I've even got the message here. If you want me to play it, yeah. Here it is.
Right, listen up.
I'm listening on 1.5 speed, which I always do. Okay.
Right, listen up. So, we're going to do this podcast shortly. My friend Ben is in Paris, and he's with Paul Gustard right now. They've invited us for a drink. We should go meet Paul Gustard and Ben now for half an hour or so, and then do the podcast in a bar or somewhere immediately after.
Right, so which meant that I went, okay, well, that's pretty cool. Phil's reply is perfect. And I replied, okay. So I got all of the podcast gear together in my rucksack. Thought, brilliant, we can have a quick beer, say hello to Paul Gustard, do the podcast. So you've already changed the story from what you said originally happened.
Is that not exactly what you said? We're going to podcast at 4 o'clock and we went to meet Ben and Paul for a beer instead.
So we'll meet them, we'll have a beer, we'll see them for half an hour, have a beer, and then do the podcast. That's what you said.
Yeah, that's what I said.
Yeah.
Anyway, go on, Phil.
I was going to say, and plans were fluid in my head because it's not often you get to meet someone with, or certainly Tim Cocker, you frequently hang out in these circles, but for JB and I, it's not that often we get to have a beer with someone with such experience and insight as Gustard, especially when, and I think this is key, because especially when they're off the clock or talking as freely as Gustard was.
He really was.
which we
cannot go into, obviously, as you understand.
We could talk some themes. We can't talk too many specifics. But
I know lots about his Stade Francais squad.
Yeah,
I thought, oh yeah, just with definitely some of that is unrepeatable. I found it genuinely one of the most fascinating rugby conversations I've been involved in. Particularly from the perspective that we often offer on the podcast, which is every single player he spoke about was not just the player, it was the player and the money. It was the player and the finance. It was the player and how much of his salary cap in the UK or in England and in France that player is taking up, whether they're EQP or GIF qualified. Like those... Like business and rugby and finance and salary cap decisions, that every single time he talks about a player, he is running the numbers on all of that.
It's incredible.
I found it truly, truly fascinating.
I did. Do you know what I found? But the one memorable thing that he said was, and it seems to be the trend when you speak to anyone in rugby who really knows what they're talking about, and you can't argue that a former England coach, current coach at Racing 92, and an incredible CV in between, you cannot argue he doesn't know exactly what he's talking about. Everyone within rugby says, with one voice, Owen Farrell...
You're not going to take that out of the whole conversation, are you? Owen, of all the things you could take, that's what you're taking, is it?
He said, and he was talking in the present tense, not just in the past tense. He was saying, Owen Farrell is England's best fly half.
Yes, he did. Yes.
And he's absolutely right.
He is absolutely right.
And that man gets respect from people that know most. And Owen Farrell gets the crap from quite often the people that know least.
Oh my god! This turned into the Owen Farrell bit. Oh wow!
I had to.
That's incredible.
Go on. Anyway, carry on.
Outstanding. I think my Ugamon you a bit later then. So yeah, you're absolutely right about the numbers, Phil. You're absolutely right, and I think it's getting more and more difficult to understand rugby if you don't understand the numbers, because you have to have a very in-depth knowledge of finance. Financing rugby players, all the qualifications, as in like what you were saying before about the GIF, the salary cap, who's excluded, who's on academy contracts, all the rest of it. So yeah, finance at the moment, it's just so important. And I don't think you can divorce that. And if you do divorce it, i.e. you separate out the two roles, which I think there's an argument for, maybe you're looking at pure coaching and then pure sort of back office.
The conversations, again, we'll have to not betray trust there, but the conversations about Harlequins were dynamite as well.
They were, weren't they? Hey, Phil, if you wanted to understand finance, where would you go?
I would, of course, go to Beardmore & Co. Independent Financial Advisor.
That's a great idea. Find me on LinkedIn. There you go. So,
hold on. Boys, you haven't done something which I think should be the first thing that you did. And I don't want to have to draw it out of you like some school teacher.
What's this now?
Flipping apologise. You're not going to apologise to our listeners for not doing a podcast.
So I think we should all apologise, because I think we should, because it was JB, you, Tim, at that point, you wanted to stop Beers with Gustard, and JB and I wanted to continue.
I was pecking you for about, because again, yeah, I have chatted to Paul Gustard several times before, but what I was doing, I was thinking of our amazing listeners who put us there in Paris in the first place. And that's why I was pecking you every like 10 minutes or so. We really need to do a podcast, lads. Come on.
Continue your thought, Will.
So I am very happy to apologise for that. I'll apologise for not stopping, but I will also say I thought it was... I think the podcast, not just now, long term, will be brighter for us not stopping and having a few more juicy Heinekens with Guzzy. Yeah.
The beers were warm. Did you not think the beers themselves were poor in that hotel?
No, the beers
The chat was amazing. The beers were terrible.
No. The beers weren't warm. The conversation was red hot.
I quite like when I'm on the continent in France, I quite like being served a little tulip glass with a big bit of foam on top, big, like a head poking out by an inch or so. The top of the tulip glass.
So I can tell you some of the questions that I asked.
Hold on. So, Phil's apologised. Anything you want to say, JB?
And I echo Phil's sentiments. We should have got a podcast out. We could have done one at half time. We could have done one.
No,
at
we couldn't have done.
Yeah, we could have. And we should have. But
if
didn't.
You'd have wanted me, okay, the way to have got a podcast done at the Racing Toulouse game would have involved me, one, not watching the game that we went to Paris to watch.
I can't remember what we watched anyway.
And which Lewis organised the whole weekend around.
But Lewis isn't there. Lewis isn't there.
Lewis was there.
Or meeting any mates ever of that group. If it wasn't for the podcast anyway, so he'll be fine if we miss 40 minutes. That
I'd rather have spent time with the boys that we were there on the weekend with than Paul Gustard.
I literally could not be more polar opposite to you. I would dump everybody in a heartbeat.
Clearly,
to go and have beers with somebody with more prominence. There is not a. A shred of doubt in my mind that that's what I would do and that's what I should do.
I know.
And besides, no, I'll leave it at that. I think that's a strong enough point. Yeah.
I'll leave the boys we were in Paris with to work out what the next sentence might have been.
100%. I would leave the boys in Paris who have come because we're all friends via the podcast because I'm talking to Paul Gustard to improve the thing which got us all to Paris in the first place. Because it is those conversations and it's those little hooks into different personalities and people in rugby and the conversation we have on a continual basis, or at least I certainly do, which I think adds so much value.
Well, that actually, what you're saying in one sense does remind me of the first night we spent in Paris when Phil and I had been there for a few hours and you kind of arrived and we went out. JB is officially the most impulsive man I know.
100%.
Because, so we were out, and it was quite a quiet Friday night. It was the end of January, and we were not really finding places that were kind of buzzing. I don't know if you remember this on the Friday night, Phil. So basically, after we went to a few places, and it was kind of not really bouncing, Phil did his research and went, okay, I've worked out where the lively places are. Well, we need to head that direction. And we all decided, right, no, let's walk for a bit. We need to get some walking done, so we get to in the right part of town. And it's amazing. It's like a goldfish memory. JB goes, okay, yeah, cool. Right, we'll do some walking. And then literally the next place with any amount of people in it, JB's like, let's go in there, boys.
That's exactly what we should do. I think I had your backing on that, Phil.
Yeah.
Oh, it was fine. It was just fine. I wasn't complaining about that.
Who remembers the singer?
I remember her.
Some of the worst jazz I've ever seen. I mean, there's never been a bigger differential between how good someone thinks they are and how bad they are.
Or how good someone looks and how good someone sounds.
Oh, she looked so magnificent, right? She looked so great that it is very clear that no one's ever told her she's terrible at jazz. Because why would you? Why would you? Even if she came up to me and I was absolutely disgusted by her, horrified by her performance, I would tell her she is great. And you can see this is a clear trend in her life.
To be clear, JB.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
when I was saying you're impulsive, that was not meant to be a I'm complaining about how Friday night went. It just made me laugh. And as you say, you end up in places that you're not expecting to be. And
the secrets of adventures.
And that's wonderful.
The secrets of adventures. Well,
one thing after the weekend on the Monday morning, Lewis did say to me because of that impulsivity, which it is something to behold. It really is. Lewis said, Tim, I finally understand how you missed the start of that Italy New Zealand game and how you boys basically left at half time.
Yep, has to be done, doesn't it? has to be done.
Good times.
Do like a good continental adventure.
Yeah. But it was the, that.
The other good story is, I guess it leads to us actually doing some research for the pod because it led to us watching the Stade Francais Bordeaux game.
Yes.
Was our Saturday morning, midday, early afternoon, late afternoon adventure.
Yeah, late afternoon, early evening adventure. Late morning, early afternoon, late afternoon, early evening adventure. Yeah.
This is a great example, right, of how things which are superficially, particularly for men, right, only men can get away with this. Women can't do it, but men can definitely do it, right? Which is how bad situations can actually turn out great for men because we actually love a bit of hardship and we love like that sort of randomness and all the rest of it. So imagine that we were three women. This would never work, would it? That we go for a little run, we get locked out of our apartment for 6 hours, and yet we manage to have an absolutely banging time and get absolutely smashed. They would be horrified of using one credit card, not doing their hair, not getting dressed, not going out. Mm. But actually, that's exactly what we did. We were in our gym kits for 8 hours?
Yeah, it was 8 hours. So at about 10 a.m. in the morning, we went out for, JB, Phil and I went out for a run. None of us took our phones.
Nope.
And Phil, fortunately, had a credit card in his pocket. When we got back to the apartment, none of the other boys were in there. And because we didn't have our phones, we had no access to what the code to get in was or contact any of the boys to ask them or get them to come back and let us in. So consequently, we were stuck on a very cold January day in just our gym kit. So we decided we would pass the time by just going to local eateries on the way.
Well, we started with a coffee
nearby.
Then we had another coffee. And then we got upsold by the very charismatic...
Yeah, that's right.
The very charismatic waiter for some cognac.
And yeah, that's right. He was like, coffee. And he went, oh, it was about not even midday by this point. And he said, oh, cognac?
Let's point out, right, what amazing foresight by that man. I don't know if even I would try and sell three cognacs to three guys in gym kit. It just isn't, it's just not how it goes, is it? You see three guys in their workout gear, you don't really think they're going to want three lots of hard spirits immediately, do you?
And then the biggest beers I've ever seen.
Oh, yes.
Like Steins, 2-pint Steins or something.
Yeah.
He brought us some of those over.
And we had, Phil gave us a little architectural quiz on the makeup of Parisian roofs, which are made of zinc, I believe. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah, in the Houseman.
And then we went
in
to
the Houseman buildings.
That's right. Then we went to the next place, which showed us the Bordeaux game. And we watched the Bordeaux Stade Francais game.
Which was tremendous.
It was a really good game, that. It really was a good game, that Bordeaux backline. But they lost.
Yeah, Stade Francais won.
They lost, which is incredible.
And we were obviously well prepped to speak to the Stade Francais director of rugby the following evening, having watched that game in some depth.
Wasn't the Jeremy Ward story interesting? So, the Stade Francais, their captain when they came to sail, he might even be the club captain, I don't know, but there's a guy called Jeremy Ward who plays 13 or 12, usually 13, I understand.
13, yeah.
And they found him because they were scouting Andre Esterhazen, and then this guy kept on replacing whoever, Lukano Am, was it?
Yeah, Lukano Am, yeah.
I was like, who is this guy who's replacing Lukano Am? He's class. And then they bought him and put him to work at Stade Francais, which is a really cool story. You never know. You never know who's watching, do you?
Yeah, that was cool. That was really cool because they were also Esterhazen and Lukano Am were two people that were trying to scout. And oh well, actually, this guy's really good.
Yeah, yeah,
and a lot cheaper than Lukano Am.
A lot cheaper. Now, back to the numbers thing. Do what I got thinking about that, which is the numbers in rugby aren't quite right, are they? Because they keep on talking about how much these players cost, not how much they cost to them. So they keep saying, oh, someone's worth 25 grand. But they're all worth 25 grand, for instance, if they're playing for Leicester Tigers. But you can't get that same player for 25 grand, can you? So they're always talking with false numbers.
Yeah, I guess it's how much they're paying them, as in how much my salary cap is taken up by this guy.
Yeah.
I was reading it.
Let's not talk about the player, but there was a player who's played multiple amounts that Dom Brandt was. I was like, why?
A player that was
six when times. Dom Brandt
six first, Dom Brandt.
Yeah, five or six times what Dom Brandt was being paid when Dom Brandt first burst onto the
and team. Even when Dom Brandt first arrived, he was far, far greater in value on the rugby pitch than this individual was, who was being paid many multiples.
Now, this is not my point. I've never actually said this. Or if I have said it, I've always given the quote to somebody else. But Mark Evans always points out that Gustard should get a lot of credit for the Harlequins team that subsequently won the Premiership because of the recruitment. It was his recruitment that did so well when they finally won. And that'd be Esterhazen, that'd be Green, and there's a few others too. It's an interesting point, because to be frank, I never gave him much credit for anything he did at Harlequins, and still probably don't in hindsight.
Well, actually, one of the elements which I think we quizzed Paul Gustard on, and I think which came out, and he wasn't blowing his own trumpet with this, but is that he was, I was going to say beneficiary, but it's the opposite of whatever the beneficiary. He had to deal with contracts which John Kingston had signed, which maybe weren't great value for the club.
Well, that's interesting, isn't it?
Because so he was hamstrung by those.
I think it's really interesting, because every time a director of rugby comes in, so do you know in football they always say, oh, it's the fitness of the boys, so they always blame like the fitness, we've got a new fitness regime, so on and so forth. I think in rugby the thing is now the contracts. You know, I've always got to deal with someone else's contracts, and by definition a director of rugby will be valuing different players very, very differently depending on what their style is, depending on what they value as an individual. I mean, there's so many other things, so it doesn't really surprise me that he didn't like the Kingston contracts. I bet you if you put Kingston in right now, he wouldn't like the latest set of contracts done by whoever.
That's
it is.
Fair. And, very fair.
I think this goes round and round. It's very hard in rugby, and this is why Leicester Tigers have done so well with their recruitment, to find a director of rugby to replace your outgoing director of rugby who likes the contracts that you have. Very, very difficult.
Mm. Fair.
So, one final thing on this Guzzy conversation, because I was reflecting on it this week, and it just cemented in my mind something that I've definitely said, I think all of us have said in the past, which is from a fan's perspective when you're watching any club rugby, but particularly in the English Premiership, because the salary cap is so tight, it would be so much better if there was transparency over the players' contracts.
Yes.
Because then you could understand the decision why player X is there or player Y is there, because they're a quarter of player Z, or you could actually get angry and say, well, hang on a minute, 20% of my entire playing budget is made up by these two players, and they're not there half the time.
Exactly.
It would help. And because like the NFL, it's all transparent, isn't it? All player contracts, you know what everyone is paid.
Do you know
what? It would help so much with fan engagement.
You have scrum success, you have line-out success, you have points scored, points conceded, all the things on the stats in the build-up to the game. And the one stat they should have, it's probably more important than any other stat, is money on the field. Starting money on the field. It could be Bristol. I wouldn't be surprised if Bristol have gone into a game with less than £2 million on the field.
Obviously that is a very low percentage of their total, but huge swathes of their total
just through injuries
being tied up in like five players who are unavailable either through international or injury or both.
Yeah, so that would be the key thing. Like, you know, when Bath come to town, how much money is on that field? And the closer you are to 4 million or whatever the cap number is, that would be how the betting markets would probably operate best, by what money is on the field. And then you'd know all, you know, how about this? Average money on the field compared to points. So you might end up fourth.
Yeah.
If you've got the lowest average money on the field. That's what they need to do. I mean, why do I have to solve all of rugby's problems on a constant basis for everybody?
I really think there is a big trick being missed there. It would be so good for transparency and for engagement. Never mind.
They need to listen to us more.
Can we do a short Patreon pod with maybe peeling back some more layers on that conversation and some more memories and stories from Paris? I think that's the least we deserve to give our patrons.
Do I have to do it tonight?
Yeah, we said we would.
Oh, Jesus. Okay.
Yeah. Either, or do we do it next week?
No.
Because we definitely do a Patreon pod.
We've got to.
All right. Well, all right. Let's give everyone what they want. Some England chat.
Yes. Here we go.
What?
Or some Italy chat.
Or some child abuse chat. Let's do England and then let's do this child abuse story.
Okay.
Okay.
Right. Well, I'm going to be honest. Of all the games, this is the one I spent the least time watching. I was very impressed with some of the stuff that Italy did. In fact, I was really impressed with some of the stuff Italy did. But then I couldn't really work out, am I impressed with what Italy did or were England just very confused in defence?
England were definitely confused in defence at times. For most of the second half, they seemed to get their act together and shut Italy down, apart from the last 5 minutes. In the first half, and there was two tries, and particularly the second one, I think it was, the Tommaso Allan try.
Yeah,
they looked phenomenally confused. When the ball breaks from the left-hand side,
phase as well, it's off a line-out.
Was it first phase off the line-out?
I think it was a turnover. No, I'm getting confused with the one of the Scotland tries. Anyway, it doesn't matter.
I don't think the second try, the Tommaso Allan try, was. If it was first phase off a line out, that would be the most confused backline you could ever possibly see, because it was Joe Marler and Ollie Chesson defending the 10-12 channels. So that's a problem if that's how you set up for a line out. Your primary line out jumper and one of your primary lifters.
Yeah, no, obviously I'm mistaken on that front, but. In the words of Brian Habana on that Sage advert, England looks slow in the turn.
Oh, my word. The less we talk about the Six Nations adverts, for the benefit of...
Adult nappies, Brian Habana still going on about being slow in the turn. What is Brian Habana's business, by the way?
I have no idea. I have no idea what Brian Habana does. Do we want to mention the other famous star who's... in lots of adverts at the moment?
What, the spot motorway sponsoring the Six Nations with Lawrence Dallaglio?
It's heartbreaking.
She's a winner. He's a winner. Yeah, he's a winner. On the day after he got banned from driving for 6 months.
Oh, Lawrence. It's not good, is it?
Which probably means he does have a car to sell, quite possibly.
It's so bad. Do you remember Bernie Madoff, the Stanford? Is it Stanford? His company, Bernie Madoff? Stanford Associates?
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, so there was two big pyramid schemes. There was Stanford Associates and there was another one.
Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae and all that jazz.
No, that was not similar to that. It was... I can't remember exactly what it was. Anyway, doesn't matter. We'll come back to that. One of the upshots of that is a lot of people who were formerly rich then had to do lots of work which they otherwise wouldn't. And remember the actor... Is it Kevin Bacon?
Yep.
Started doing all the EE adverts. That's because he lost all of his money through Bernie Madoff.
Is that right?
That is right, yeah.
Wow, correct. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
It's one of these like really demeaning things where, I just feel sorry for the guy. Now, the motorway adverts, first of all, they're awful. And then, second of all, I guess you've got to pay your tax bill somehow, haven't you? So, I completely appreciate why you've got to do it, but I don't like watching them.
Makes you sad.
It actually does make me really sad.
I quite like seeing who is investing in the money that is paying for the rugby that I'm watching, in that sense. Like people talk about BBC free to air. The BBC is not free to air.
It's not free.
It's £159
per
household.
It's taken me 10 years to persuade you of this, but yes, the BBC is not free.
So at least ITV is actually legitimately free to air, although you have to pay the £159 to the BBC in order to be able to watch ITV. Watch it.
Thanks, guys.
Yeah. Anyway. Good pundits as well, just generally talking. I think there's been an upgrade. You mentioned Dan Bigger already. It's part of the team. That'll be for ITV when the Wales games come. But you've no Sir Clive.
No Sir Clive. Sadly, we've still got to put up with Sonia McLaughlin, who's not apologised for her Exeter tweet yet, which is interesting because I wanted to talk about that later. Still nothing from Hugo Monier apologising for his Exeter tweet. And even more egregious last week, I didn't get to speak about it last week because of the no podcast. But Sonia McLaughlin has tweeted that she can't apologise for it, she can't take it back, because it's a police matter. It's not a police matter. Apparently she's a journalist. That's what I heard. That's how she describes herself. She doesn't know the first thing about the police process. So, absolute shame. So, yeah, unfortunately we've got to put up with those pundits still. Gareth Thomas.
What I would say, yeah, no Gareth Thomas.
That's great news. That so is, finally we're
although
freed
he,
from him.
He is. I saw he was advertised on a BBC discussion show about the rugby. So not a main pundit, but he's still getting work.
Incredible, isn't it? It's absolutely incredible.
I'm not as invested in the Exeter Chiefs story as you, but just to clarify, I believe I'm right in saying Hugo Monier has deleted the tweet.
You are 100% right. He has deleted his tweet. I wonder why. Oh, that's right. Because it's all lies. Never mind.
I'm not saying that, but I'm just pointing out the facts.
I'm pretty sure right now we can look back at this and say, oh, look at that. Race-baiting lies. And that's what it was. And, you know, the cost for those two individuals, Sonia and Hugo, for tweeting what they tweeted, is nothing. The cost to Exeter Chiefs, we literally can't measure. We literally can't measure. And nothing will be done, and nothing will be said, and it will be completely buried. So,
Should we go to the game? The England game?
Yeah, so Gobbezi and Gobbezi look great. I quite like Brex. Tomasso Allan.
Yeah, Menoncello and Brex is nice balance, isn't it?
It is, yeah, it is. They are institutional losers at this point, though, aren't they? That's just what they do. They just lose over and over again. I think they're going to need some absolutely incredible world-class talent just to change the mindset of the nation.
Yeah.
That's what I think. I don't think having equivalent talent or talent which is nearly there will be close to being enough for them to actually win a handful of games.
I think, yeah, it depends where you set the target of their ambition. Because for the last 20 years, they win one game every four seasons and they are competitive in one game a year. And this might be the one game that they're competitive. They might actually win one more game, but they're not there. Despite having some lovely players that you've just mentioned, they've got some great players across the board.
They really have.
But equally, I mean, if the high of last season was they came within 5 points of beating France, or 5 points of drawing with France, the opening game to last year's Six Nations, they had 96 points, I think it was, put on them by the All Blacks. There's no other top-tier team, or even not many of the second-tier teams, who would get such a humiliation. So there is still a long, long way for Italy to go.
Yeah, yeah, completely agreed. What do we think of England's, or the new England, England under Borthwick 1.1 or 2.0 or whatever you want to call it? The Jamie George era.
Okay, I'll say a couple of things. Firstly, before we move on to the new faces, I think that there is... Now that the Moaners have got Owen Farrell off the scene, just make sure I get a bit of Faz in there. Now the people that moan have got Faz off the scene, there is this strange negativity. It's almost like the negativity is latent and it's there in the ether and it has to be directed at someone. And if Owen Farrell's not there, well, okay, they're not going to be satisfied. I've still got this negativity I have to get out of my system. And it seems to be directed now at, weirdly, George Ford and Elliot Daly. It's like almost anyone that's been an England stalwart and an awesome player and is 30 years of age or older, so, is just getting weird levels of shit. I don't get it.
Where are you getting this from, Tim? Like, where is this coming from? As in, is this a Twitter thing, or is this... the reason I ask this is a genuine question. I didn't watch the game with any sound on. I watched it with complete neutrals, so I didn't get any feedback there. And I've not read the papers today regarding the England performance. So is there something in the papers?
No, this is fans.
On Twitter?
Like whether it's Twitter, Reddit, YouTube comments. Yeah.
Ah, your YouTube comments. Yes. Okay. That's quite a good way to engage. Right. Yeah. Okay. I mean,
strange. People going, oh, I don't know why George Ford was starting. So it was like,
I've got a few ideas.
I remember only 3 months ago when it was like, when George Ford was England's saviour and people were outraged that George Ford was not starting at 10.
I see the daily criticism. He's a 31-year-old winger.
Who's really good at rugby.
But he is good at rugby. It's not like he's terrible. He hasn't been on form for a long time, I don't think. Like
he was amazing in a World Cup semi-final.
Yeah, I mean, he's just, you know, his club form has been okay. I mean, he's played.
Yeah.
Has he been like, I think people get frustrated when you watch a Premiership week in, week out, and the players for England are not the best players in the Premiership. He's been very good when he's played, but he hasn't been one of the... He's not Caden Murphy.
No. Okay, and Steve Borthwick did select on form, and Tommy Freeman was brilliant. But just on Elliot Daly
for a second...
Imagine
how good Will Muir would have been.
Yeah, just on Elliot Daly for a second. During the World Cup, he had an incredible semi-final and was amazing and almost, you know, had a massive part in England getting to a final. And Henry Arundel, the guy that everyone wanted to be picked ahead of him, does nothing.
Well, and also he's out of the limelight now. But the thing is, with Henry Arundel playing in France, as has happened to almost every England player, once you're in France, you're really coveted. Like, you become the best player on the planet. So that's probably something. It's probably something in that too. George Ford has not been superb this season. He's been good.
He's been injured a lot.
Yeah, and I guess there's just frustration where you look at Finn Smith. Finn Smith is driving that Northampton team to heights that not even Northampton thought they could reach. So I get the frustration, but I also say it does seem a bit silly because, I mean, there's lots of reasons to pick George Ford. There's lots of reasons to pick him. There's lots of reasons to pick Elliot Daly too.
Yeah, I don't have any issues with those two playing at all.
No, I can't say that I do, to be honest.
Yeah, they're both superb players with huge experience playing where you want them to be playing. So, yeah. No complaints from me.
I'm gonna say one more thing when it comes to England, saying I think Eddie Jones, the further away we get from Eddie Jones, the more I think he might be right on his test match animal thing. And I thought we saw two more examples of that from an England perspective.
Okay.
Ethan Roots and Chandler Cunningham South.
Cunningham South looks like he might be an international player, doesn't he?
He does, and he can't. Crikey. As we mentioned on last two weeks ago, he's kind of fourth or fifth choice in the back row for Harlequins, but on an international field, he looks the business.
Yeah, he does. I have no complaints about him playing now. Zero. He looks dynamic. He looks every part an international player, which, yeah, that's quite impressive stuff. I won't be surprised if he starts next.
As does Tommy Freeman.
Tommy Freeman is a god.
Freeman.
I'm certain of it.
He was superb. He's so good. He's so hard to bring down. He reads the game so well. And he's big, fast and strong. And what more do you want?
Exactly. And to dovetail, and I'm not getting on Henry Arundel's back. No one was...
Did Henry Arundel even play?
No. I was just going to say...
This is like the third mention of Henry Arundel.
What Tommy Freeman did do, which when we saw Racing last week and when we watched England at a World Cup, what Henry Arundel, for all his incredible things, what he didn't do, Tommy Freeman, just like Jack Knoll, who, by the way, Paul Gustard absolutely says that is an elite winger.
Yeah, he's a big fan of Knoll.
A massive fan of Jack Knoll. But Tommy Freeman did exactly the sort of thing Jack Knoll would have done for that Elliot Daly try. Tommy Freeman, the right winger, pops up in the outside centre channel on the left-hand side.
Yeah, and with England now, if you look at Daly and Freeman, both of them are very, very comfortable with moving around the park, trying to get their hands on the ball. It makes a huge difference, that.
Yeah.
It makes an absolutely huge difference. Whether they're too similar or not, I don't know. Because I know they're different in terms of like their raw pace. You know, one can kick, one can be a secondary playmaker. But maybe there is some utility of having just an out-and-out finisher who lurks on the wing to do that. Although, I don't know, it depends on... Depends on how you play. I like having wingers that make themselves available constantly and are a constant threat.
You mentioned Ethan Roots as well.
Yeah.
Who, he was man of the match. Yeah, he had a great performance. I can't work out... There's something that's missing with Ethan Roots for me. And it's not Ethan Roots. It's, why is this not a dozen other people? As in, Ethan,
I know what you mean.
Ethan Roots was second choice back row for the Ospreys last season. He comes into Exeter and he looks brilliant. And that's as much Rob Baxter as it is Ethan Roots. It's Rob Baxter identifying talent and getting him playing to all of his strengths. So brilliant. Well done, Rob Baxter. But then he's a decent sized back row and he's decently athletic. But there are at least a dozen other kind of foreign from Bourne.
5 years ago, it could have been John Ross.
Don Armand.
Don Armand, Hanro Liebenberg, Dave Ewers for many years, Jacques Vermaelen, Stefan Levies.
John Ross.
Yeah, John Ross. Like there are dozens who played in the Premiership for the last few years. Why? And like, I'm not complaining about Ethan Roots because he was brilliant and he played superbly well this season. But like, I clearly know I'm not good enough to know this, and I want to know what I'm missing, what we're all missing that Borthwick and Baxter can see in these guys.
I think you touched on something before, which was the Baxter connection. And it's, I mean, if you look at Roots, not to be unkind, he does not look like a top-level international rugby player, does he? He doesn't have the build. So if you stand him next to, think of someone who does for me, so I don't have to think.
Peter Steff-Tatoy.
Perfect. Right. That is, not only is Peter Steff-Tatoy the best player probably the world has ever seen, but he also looks like the best player that the world has ever seen, right? That's just, you know, that is that. You pick someone else, and you look at this guy, and they will get in the team because they look the part. Ethan Roots does not necessarily look the part, but he plays the part. And I think it's Rob Baxter's ability to actually work out what is necessary in a player and bring it out of them, which Steve Borthwick also appreciates. And I'm certain of that. Because why else would he be, you know, discarded from New Zealand, let go by the Ospreys, and here he is playing?
But then I guess the bit then that doesn't... Because I get all of that. But then why not Don Armand or Dave Ewers or...
Well, Don Armand did make Marlon? It.
He played one game?
Yeah. I've got six in my head.
No, well, he played a couple of games. He definitely went on that Argentina tour and then...
He played against France.
And then he played against France, but I think that's basically it. A handful of tests.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I don't know why not Don Armand.
He wasn't just a solid player at Exeter Chiefs. He was the best back row player in the Premiership for about 3 years.
I remember in the Premiership final, Austin Healey saying, "And he's built like a skip." And I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but he was very good.
Great. It's a good point, Phil. And maybe it's when you think about the players that England do not have and haven't had, Thomas Francis would be another great example.
Look at the current tight head at Exeter now.
Aaron Painter.
Aaron Painter. You know, he's obviously got some incredible qualities that Northampton just were not able to use. Exeter can, and that's what makes Exeter so special. Feu Wabosu wasn't used. Do you think he was put on the bench, hopefully to force Steve Borthwick to use him, so he's capped? Because it's a very suspicious when a head coach does not use his bench.
Well, he brought him on for a little
did
bit.
He? Come did on, he
yeah.
Came on
for a little bit, yeah.
What, yeah, right, at the end?
2 minutes.
Yeah. Get his 20. Yeah.
He's the new Dan Robson.
Get his 20k, and then yeah, that's it. I'm always suspicious when that happens. I think it's probably politics. Okay, good. Yeah, so that's another one which Rob Bax has just sort of discovered. Although, how much discovering you need for a really fast winger, I don't know. So anything else on the new Dingwell?
Didn't have a great day. He was at fault for the second Italy try. But I hope he gets another chance.
I think so. I think you need to persevere with him. Just give him, if he works in that 12 channel, it will revolutionise England because it'll just be a problem that they don't have. They need to solve that problem. And they need to do it now. And he's as good as anyone.
Sorry, I'm just looking up
Don Armand.
So Don Armand has played, he's got two caps. And it's a total of, so he's both off the bench, one against Argentina, one against Ireland. I think it's a total of about 25 minutes if you've played for England.
That is shocking, isn't it? Ethan Roots has already got more minutes on the field as like more than three times the game time for England than Don Arman had, the best player in the Premiership for 3 years.
But half the money. So Don Arman got paid twice. Ethan Roots has only been paid
twice. Once. So yes, that is true.
Jokes on Ethan Roots, I guess.
half the money right now.
Yeah. Well, let's just leave it there, shall we? You know, all we know is what we know. These are the facts.
Fair point, well made.
Okay, I don't think there's much more to say about it. Sorry, it's really difficult to podcast because usually when Phil's sitting next to us, I know when he's not able to talk because he's typing, because I can see him. But when I can't see him, I don't know that he's looking on his computer, not ready to talk, which is what accounts for the gaps.
So Phil, just as an Englishman, I was fairly happy with that result. Like initially, I was a bit frustrated and a bit like, oh, more of the same. But actually, personnel aside, my expectations were relatively low because we don't have great players in some positions, important positions, and we're missing quite a few guys. But I was encouraged by a little bit more that Steve Borthwick's sort of let it off the leash a little bit.
I tell you what I was disappointed by, and I don't know if you guys noticed this, I thought Alex Mitchell was not only slow to the breakdown, I thought he's slow to pass the ball as well. like ridiculously slow by international standards, and by his own standards for Northampton too.
Well, I think a part of that, because I did notice that a few times, he wasn't at the back of the breakdown. I think that's partly almost touched on what I was saying there, is England were going a little bit wider a bit sooner.
Maybe. But like, he plays for Northampton, this shouldn't be a problem.
Mm.
I don't know what it was.
Yeah, interesting.
But he just wasn't covering the ground quick enough to get to the breakdown to move it. Or unless England weren't making enough yards after contact to keep the ball up to get him there. I don't know what it was, but he didn't seem as effective as he does for his club.
Yeah, he wasn't as effective. I would agree with that. I didn't notice the speed that much. There was a couple of times, yes. But overall, as an England fan, kind of nonplussed. Did the bare minimum, which is you have to beat Italy. Got a little bit nervous in the first half until things calmed down. And big negatives with the defence. But I'm sure that will come because we had big negatives in the Sinfield era of defence, which ended very, very well from a World Cup semi-final perspective. So, I'm certain that will come with under Felix Jones, unless he is just another version of
Matt Proudfoot
or Ben Ryan syndrome. It's not the coaches that are really good. It is the fact that they are coaching the best players on the planet. And it wouldn't matter whether it was them, Gaultier, or me and JB
coaching them. Do you know how many tackles Peter Steptoe would make if I was coaching him? Broadly speaking, a lot.
Exactly the same number he'd make with you not coaching him.
Do you know how violent Quagga Smith would be if I coached him? Pretty violent. He'd be pretty violent.
Yes. But yeah, delighted with the two new players. I thought they both played, let me be specific, Freeman and Roots, two of the new players who I thought were superb. And here's one bit for slight optimism. Tight head prop is a problem position.
Yep.
Scrum was fine in this game. No major issues, although there was one late penalty against Benno Abano for an early bind, but that is neither here nor there. Will Stewart, I had in my head that he'd be, say, 30 or 31.
24.
He's not that young. He's 27 with 33 international caps. So he is only really just coming into his kind of prime time as an international tight head. So, and he's got some good guys to learn from at Bath, particularly some of the good South Africans that he's got to learn from at Bath. So maybe not all is lost. Maybe we have got some options there at scrum time.
Agreed with basically everything you said there. What do you want to do next? Uh, next week's games, or let's just child abuse story because it has made headlines. It made the front page of the Bloody Telegraph.
I'll tell you what, I will. And the big BBC Radio 5 Live had it as their phone in on Friday morning, the day of the Six Nations. I'll tell you what, so let's just wrap up that. So the Six Nations are, as I mentioned earlier, the big game, the biggest of the games in round two, Scotland v France, 2:15 on Saturday at Murrayfield. Prediction, you're going for France?
France. Yeah, France.
France.
I think France narrowly. England v Wales at Twickenham, 4:45.
Got to be England. They have to.
Wales.
And Ireland v Italy on Sunday.
Ireland. Yeah. Easy. That was easy. Like that.
Great. Ireland will get a handy bonus point win.
Yep. So who is this person or these people? These are researchers, right?
So I kind of know this guy, I think, if it's the guy I'm thinking of. And I remember watching him talk, and I remember thinking, God, what a pompous idiot. And the reason I know him is because he shared a stage with someone that I interviewed for Rugby Dungeon once called Dr. Darren White, whose name I carry on getting mixed up. Now, if you don't remember Dr. Darren White, superficially sounds reasonable, but actually his behaviour behind the scenes is absolutely abhorrent. And he's the guy who did, you know, stupid things like making posters equating world rugby with smoking. Just idiotic stuff, which is all basically designed to propel their careers rather than advance anything in rugby, really. And they make their money out of telling all players are going to die a horrible death and there's nothing that can be known and we need more evidence. And no matter what evidence comes out, we need more evidence and that kind of thing. So he's one of them. And they shared a stage together. And I remember watching this guy talk and he tried to do it in a Steve Jobs style. So he's very confident of his abilities. Sadly, he was far too confident of his abilities because he's an absolutely dreadful presenter. Dreadful. And I think his name's Anderson, is it?
Professor Eric Anderson.
Yeah, this is the guy.
Let's play the ball, not the man, though.
Let's absolutely play the man. So I think with this guy, you do have a guy who is... I mean, he's been pushing this narrative now. When I did the Darren White interview, it must have been 3 or 4 years ago, and this guy has been at this for about 8 years now. About 8 years. Same with Alison Pollock. They're part of the same crew, and they always invoke the European Convention of Human Rights. This is what they do. And it's about consent. So the argument goes something like, you can't consent for a child, and the child can't consent for a child, and therefore you can't play rugby. So it's child abuse. But then... can a child consent to go skateboarding? Can a child consent to climb a tree? Like, what is it that a child can consent to do? And it's just that what they do is they take human rights law, which is designed for things like refugees coming out of Syria, like really substantial, serious topics, and they try and apply them to things like rugby. And they do so for many, many reasons. And I don't think they'll ever disclose the real reasons that they do it, but they're basically cultural and political. This is really, in a lot of ways, like a no story. No, actually, I'll tell you what the story is. It's not the story. The story isn't a sporting story, is it? It's not a story about is there child abuse in rugby or does this lack of consent equal child abuse? That isn't the story at all. The story is exactly how are there institutions in the United Kingdom where someone like this can make a living on, I don't know how much a university lecturer gets paid, but I'm guessing it's like £50,000-£60,000 a year, continuously for about 6 years, and no one decide, well, not 6 years, he's been there like decades now, and no one say, hang on, what you're teaching and what you're studying and what you're producing is nonsense. Like, I run a small business. Phil, you have... a job where you're looking after figures and staff, like paying someone a substantial amount of money like that is no small feat. It's really, really difficult. And yet we've got institutions, universities, no less, in the UK, who are tolerating this kind of research. And you think that the society in of itself must be broken just to have this kind of guy churning out this nonsense and be doing so for decades. It's madness. It's absolute madness.
I've got his Winchester Is it Winchester University? University of Winchester. Ooh. Profile in front of him. And ooh, I think he's in. There's definitely some overlap with his interest in yours, JB.
I can only imagine. I can almost guarantee he'll be an LGBTQ plus campaigner. I almost guarantee that is what he's done.
So his areas of supervision, or his areas of interest, research interests, include hazing and fraternities. That sounds like something you'd be interested in.
Here we go. This is valuable research, isn't it? This will get us up the OECD rankings. Please continue.
They're probably the only ones that you'd really be interested in. Heterosexism in the classroom.
There we go. I knew it. I know these things. But... go on.
Socio-negative aspects of organised competitive sport. Impact of declining homophobia on gender.
Hang on. Wait. What? Impact of declining homophobia on gender. These are important subjects. Please continue.
gay and lesbian experiences in sport, school, or relationships. And cheating, monogamy, and relationships. Just some of the things he's interested in.
Goodness me. There you go.
Well, see, I look at it like this. There are market forces elements to researchers. Yeah. So if you are a student,
yeah,
and you pay £9,000 a year to an institution which produces research like this, you deserve the garbage education you get.
Yeah, exactly.
If you are someone who employs people and you get someone with this university on their CV, you may well look at that slightly differently than you will at others. So there are market forces that apply.
I love that, Tim. I love that. However, you know what's going to happen to, or most of his students are going to end up in HR departments, or they're going to end up in HR departments, or, you know, middle management, or they're going to be at like the DVLA, and you're trying to get your driver's license, and you've got to deal with these absolute morons who are prioritising absolutely everything else in the world except for your driver's license.
So okay, fine. I'm all right with playing the man. Let's just purely play the ball on this one. The point here is a national newspaper decided to publish this story. National radio stations decided to talk about this story when they could quite easily have ignored it if they chose not to. And part of that is because I think they recognised actually the reaction it would get would be anger of people in response we have.
Can I just point out, there was another story, and I'll come back to this, because what you're basically reciting here is the Pollock Doctrine, which is you recycle your trash research every single time Six Nations is up.
Yes.
Because that's when you know to do it, yeah. Right? That's what she does. You know, if you look at the research, it is garbage. I mean, like, if you speak to real people, in this field, as I have, people I actually really respect and are trying to make a difference to it, it's almost laughable. But the real laughable thing is they don't get the coverage. You know, the real researchers don't get the coverage. These ones with their trendy topics do.
There's a little bit of a Streisand effect here, though, because by talking about it, we are elevating this garbage research.
Yeah, mm-hmm. But, you know, in a way, like, if everyone's focusing on this and it's clearly something that belongs in clown world, you know, fine. There is another story that came out today in The Observer, and I think this is much more pertinent. It is about academic fraud. And have you heard of the replication crisis?
Yes.
Yeah.
So apparently the replication crisis is worse than it's ever been, and most of it is in the social sciences. Now, The Observer take the angle that it's from, you know, factory, what they call paper mills, so people writing these false papers to try and get into journals and people running journals taking bribes, so they publish work and all the rest of it. But ultimately, all of the research that these so-called researchers are creating cannot be replicated. And the whole point of the knowledge that they're meant to be producing is it can be replicated. That's how we know it's true. That's why you do experiments. It no longer matters, really, in the social sciences, sciences, because they're completely broken.
Well, the perfect example of this is the... what are they called? The fake studies that those...
Oh, yeah.
Oh, what are they called?
Fat bodybuilding, that kind of thing.
Yeah, James Lindsay... And Peter Boghossian, and another person,
Helen Penrose
wrote these deliberately to expose how ridiculous these research papers are, these research journals are.
Conceptual penises.
Yeah, they wrote articles like why
heteronormative rape in dog parks.
Heteronormative rape in dog parks. Yes.
Yeah, and you know when Phil just listed this guy's areas of interest, I honestly didn't know anything about him. I just knew LGBTQ would feature prominently, and bingo. It's like, you know, these people are so boring, you know what they think before you even know.
But I'm going to say these newspapers and national radio stations that decided to put it front and centre because they knew it would get... That's the real issue for me. It's like, what are you doing even engaging?
Well, I think the problem here is like twofold. Like, there is this national hysteria. Not national hysteria, like... There's cultural hysteria, isn't there, that there's certain hot-button topics that we must talk about. It's why Ugo Monyo got so much traction for his lies on racism and exorcism. I mean, there are certain things that you say, and it automatically gets traction, and no one dares question you. And one of the things would be, you know, sexuality or race or gender or those sorts of things. So when you've got a, you know, air quotes, academic, I don't think he's anything of the such, this guy, pushing these things... Then the press will pick up on it, and all that this guy is doing is he's playing the game, isn't he? He's playing the game using some of these titles, some of these words, some of these topics, which are inherently trendy, in order to get the coverage to build his career. I mean, it's a game as old as time.
Yeah.
So
well, yeah. I mean, I'd just say finally, rugby isn't for everyone. And I think in schools there should be an optional element if you really don't want to join in.
Can I just talk about something?
But there's just that it's child abuse is ridiculous. And one thing they never ever mention in this, people talk about like, oh, head injuries, dangers, all the rest of it. They never ever mention the counterfactual benefits.
This is an interesting point, right? So if you look at his area of expertise, I don't need to read a single thing of what he's written to know that I'm going to disagree with it all and it's all going to be trash, right? Like, interesting in hazing. Now, hazing's an American term, but we'd call it initiation. I appreciate that people don't like that, and I appreciate that it is, a bit of an art as to how far you push something like an initiation. But it's incredibly important, and it's certainly incredibly important to a bunch of men when they're bonding, because that's how men do things. And when you get these weird academic
if it's consensual, just you've got no business having any say on it.
I mean, it kind of is consensual, and it's kind of not consensual, isn't it? I mean, like, I don't really want to do the things that are going to make me do, but I will do it. And you've got to know, like, where is that limit? Because people do go too far, and they do push the limits. And at some point, when you push the limits too far, some action needs to be taken, but that action can be internal. And I always think, like, will this make a good story in 6 months' time? Because if the answer is yes, we should definitely do it. If the answer is no, we definitely should not do it.
But if someone there said, I'm not cool with this, and I've seen this, so I coach at Manchester Metropolitan University, and I see the team I'm on. I'm on the WhatsApp group. I don't engage in any of this, these sort of comments, but these sort of messages. But the captain will say, right, social theme for this Wednesday. And they seem to have a social every bloody Wednesday as well.
Yeah, it's every Wednesday.
Social theme for this Wednesday is this. People dress up. We're meeting here. We're doing this. If you're not drinking, bring milk. And that's basically it. It's like, come and join in. You can have all the fun, but no worries if you don't drink. Just bring milk.
Bring milk. I mean, and we never had that in Bristol, Uwe. I would be frowned upon. You know, it just says, doesn't it? I mean, what this guy doesn't get, because you can write about things all you want, but if you haven't actually experienced them, and he hasn't experienced them, I know this, because I think I know basically everything about the guy without ever meeting him, then... You can't really write about it. The whole point of the initiation thing is you're with a bunch of guys who will do things for each other. Like, you know that guy will push the boundaries. That's why we do it. It's like a club, isn't it? It's like, these are the things. Now, I wouldn't do it now because I'm older, but it was massively important when you're in your 20s. I mean, pushing the boat out. You remember, Phil, in Lancaster University, do they have, like, the hard work desk?
Hard work desk,
right?
Yeah.
Hard work desk is, if you didn't want to do your fines or some such thing, you were put on the hard work desk. You open up this desk. It's not an old school school desk, and inside it was lots of alcohol, but you had to drink. You just had to do it. And no one's allowed to talk to you. They're not allowed to speak to you, not allowed to look at you, and you've got to have no fun, and you've just got to have all of the alcohol. That's funny. It's great. And like, you go through... Yeah. Sorry, go on, Phil.
I was going to say, it was whoever had been the most hardworking the preceding week leading up to that point So whether it's like refusing to do something or losing your kit or not going training or that kind of thing. And it's like a almost corrective behavior. Like it's to set the standards. And obviously drinking, there are other ways to do that. And not all drinking is good drinking, but it's just a good fun way of getting some camaraderie.
Yeah. I heard a statistic today, sadly, which is suicide is still the major cause of major, if not the most major cause of death of men under 50. And one of the big things which they cite continuously is loneliness, because it gets more and more difficult for men to sort of communicate and more difficult for men to discuss things. Yeah. And the problem we have is dickheads like this guy pushing their worldview, which is effectively like this sort of like middle class female university educated like worldview. And they're doing things like telling men that, you know, you should talk, it shouldn't be so toxic, it shouldn't be so masculine. And it seems to be driving more and more men to do things like suicide. And men are the only people in the world that get blamed for their own suicide. I mean, if women were killing themselves at this sort of rate, there'd be all sorts of things done to, you know, stop it happening. It'd be a national disgrace. But for men, it doesn't really matter. So men don't really talk very well face-to-face. And the lovely saying that I heard is, they don't talk face-to-face, but they do like to stand shoulder-to-shoulder.
Which is why those, like...
It's why rugby works for them.
And why those men shed things is the thing that pops up.
Yeah.
We're not going to come and sit round in a circle and talk about our problems directly, but let's get together and build an engine.
Yeah, let's have a drink, or, you know, whatever the thing is. And initiations and rugby clubs and all of those things do exactly that. And, you know, as you get older, there are different ways to manage that. But when you're young, you really need those social networks. So this idiot, and there's different ones as well. Like you say, Tim, rugby's not for everyone. But trying to, you know, describe it as, you know, child abuse, when it's given me so much personally, I mean, the abusive thing would be not to let me play.
But the thing is, just to go back to it, and maybe, well, possibly where we end and move on from, but I honestly think the reason why this newspaper published it and the reason why BBC Radio 5 Live put it as their lead phone-in topic for the day on Friday is because the vast majority of people agree with you and I and the three of us.
Well,
and they knew it would get a reaction.
The Telegraph would put it up because, like, it clicks. Yeah, clicks for their readers. Their reader base is basically like us, isn't it? It's like, oh my God, this is ridiculous. The BBC put it up because they actually worship at the altar of credentialism. This guy is a academic. I mean, he's no expert on anything. I can tell you that for free. And it's basically run by, you know, white middle class university educated women. I mean, this is what they like talking about. This is what they think is important. That's just, you know, if you meet all the producers, they're lovely, they're well meaning, but that's just who works there. That's the decisions that they make. They probably thought it was a serious story, and they probably thought it affects various communities. That's probably what they thought. It was innocent, but it's from their worldview, and their worldview is very precise.
And Tim, I agree with you that the pushback that we've all witnessed is great. Because we've been in multiple WhatsApp groups where everyone is saying, look at this, how ridiculous, you're just telling one half of the story. The problem is that there are big groups that we're not in or not part of, and this is just another negative mark for rugby.
I'll give you a big thing to worry about or look forward to. So our friends North Dorset, you remember them?
Yeah,
yeah, North Dorset. Well, North Dorset are on a bit of a winning streak. In fact, I believe that they're winning their league. Do you know what happens next if they win their league? Do you know where they go?
National leagues?
All of Dorset?
That's right. Whole Dorset League. No, they go into the same league as Marlow and Aylesbury. Can you imagine that league next year? That, I mean, why we didn't lead off with that story rather than bloody Six Nations, I do not know.
Well, also, I was just thinking, Marlow got a win this week against Fullerians.
Yeah, also some sad news coming out of Marlow. Have you seen that email?
No.
Sad news and also sort of like...
Yeah. I haven't looked at any emails this week.
Yeah. Well, okay, so I will preference this. It is from Marlow, and everybody except for Tim does hate Marlow, and rightly so. But sadly, they were playing a game this weekend, One of their lads, Tony Giles, played second half against Falerians, and sadly his father earlier on this week passed away.
So
well done for playing. Clifford Giles was his father, and stalwart of Marlow RFC, and he can be very proud of the fact that he would have been one of the few men alive who liked Marlow just like you, Tim. So yeah, go well,
bless. And also, it's been pointed out by quite a few people on email that the biggest result of the weekend was in the Rugby Europe Championship, and this is not great when you consider the World Cup 3 months ago. Belgium 10, Portugal 6.
Now,
that's disastrous for Portugal.
I've not seen this game.
Or great for Belgium.
Great for Belgium potentially. The last time there was an upset on Belgian soil, there was a refereeing anomaly. thanks to the Romanian RFU. Now, I'm not suggesting that happened in this case at all. I've not seen the game, but
not ruling it out did, either.
It reminded me of those sad times. But take it on face value. Fair play, Belgium, because 3 months ago, Portugal legitimately beat Fiji.
Yeah,
who are a hell of a team.
So that means Belgium. Belgium beat a team that beat Fiji, that beat England. So Belgium are better than England. And England, who did England beat? England have beaten loads of teams. So,
in the last year and a half, England have beaten South Africa. So Belgium are World Cup champions.
Yeah, Dean Ryan logic right there.
Yeah,
checks out to me. Nice.
Ideal. Dean Ryan logic, you love it.
But that might scupper plans for us going to Lisbon.
Because they're not going to make the final.
Well, they might not make the knockouts, because if they it looked like if they were going to win their half of the pool that they would get guaranteed a home semi-final. But they're not going to, it doesn't look like they're going to win their half of the pool now, so they're not going to get a home semi-final. So well done, Belgium. Ruining it for everyone.
Yeah. Cheers, Belgium.
Yeah, cheers.
Right, we're going to do a quick Patreon pod. Patreon.com/eggchasers is where you can help keep the lights on, support the podcast. There's so many people do, and we're so grateful for your support. Thank you for listening. Hit subscribe wherever you get your podcast. Tell your mates, and let the boys end.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.